The Five Leadership Questions podcast is brought to you by Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Southeastern desires to equip pastors, missionaries, theologians, scholars, and other believers to obey the commands of Jesus to make disciples anywhere and everywhere God calls them to go. They have a wide range of degrees at many levels. Whether you want to become a pastor, missionary, or seminary professor, Southeastern can provide you with the high-quality education and training that you need. Southeastern even provides a number of distance education options for those who are interested but cannot relocate. To learn more, visit sebts.edu/5LQ. That's sebts.edu/5LQ. Now, enjoy the podcast. Hey, and welcome to the Five Leadership Questions podcast. I am your host, Barnabas Piper. I co-host this podcast with Todd Adkins. You will hear him in just a moment when we jump into our conversation with Thomas Terry. If that name doesn't ring a bell, maybe the name Humble Beast does. If you're a Christian hip-hop fan or you like hip-hop music in general, Humble Beast is the record label that Thomas co-founded and is now the owner of. He is an artist himself, so he's done some solo albums, as well as being part of a group called Beautiful Eulogy, who's actually one of my favorite hip-hop groups. They have sort of this cool, offbeat, West Coast sound. It's unlike anything I've heard elsewhere. And that sort of sums up a lot of what Humble Beast does, because they're not just a record label. They're a collection of creative people and artists. So they deal in social justice. They have published some books. They have a blog. They put out apparel. They've even been in the coffee business. We touch on some of that. And we get into this with him about the arts, about music, about creativity and excellence, and how all of that is culturally formative. So he is an entrepreneur. He serves at his church. He's a father. He has his hands in all of these things. I ran across him a few years ago just through his music. And the lyrics of it and the poetry of it was what captured me initially. And now in this conversation, you'll hear his heart and his savvy and his, I think his humility as a leader also stands out in terms of how he's working with this group of incredibly creative people. So again, if you go to humblebeast.com, you can find all of that. And one of the coolest things that they do is that they actually give away their music for free. So you can download it, you can buy it through iTunes or through Amazon Music, or you can listen to it on Spotify or whatever. But they actually give it away for free, and then you have the option to donate to them or you have the option to purchase it. But they're so open-handed with their creativity and their excellence and the art that they create that they do that. And I think that's exceptionally cool. If you browse their store, you will see that they have some incredibly cool shirts and hats and various other apparel. Some of the artists on that label include Show Baraka and Propaganda and Jackie Hill Perry, and then Beautiful Eulogy, like I mentioned. And they're all excellent. They're all theologians. They're all cultural exegetes, so they can pick apart culture so well about different issues. So check them out. Go to humblebeast.com and look at what they do. Now here's our conversation with Thomas Terry. It's a little bit different than some of the ones we've had in the past just because of the world that he lives in and serves in, and I think that makes it exceptional. I loved having this conversation with him, and I think you will enjoy it as well. Hey, we are here today with Thomas Terry of Humble Beast, which, as you heard in the intro, is a record label, but also does a lot of other things, which we highlighted in terms of blogs, books, even clothing, the Canvas Conference, these other things. So, Thomas, thanks so much for taking the time to join us on the Five Leadership Questions podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me, brother. Appreciate you guys giving me this interview.
Absolutely. We have talked to a lot of different people on this podcast, but we haven't had a chance to talk to too many who are involved in music in the arts. So this is something I'm excited to hear about because it's obviously it's an area of significant cultural influence and leadership, and the influence that you guys have and the partnerships that you guys have are significant. Would you mind just kind of introducing yourself a little bit, introducing yourself to our listeners, some of how you got to where you are, what your present role is as an artist and as the owner of Humble Beast, and then maybe a little bit about your family, just to give us a flavor of who you are and what you do.
Sure. Well, I'm a husband. I have an amazing wife. I am a father. I have a 2.5-year-old and a 7-month-old. I'm also a pastor. I serve as one of the pastors at Trinity Church in Portland, and I also run Humble Beast. And under Humble Beast, I'm also in a hip hop trio called Beautiful Eulogy, where I make music with Braille and Cortland Urbano. I started Humble Beast a little bit over 6 years ago. And really it was, it came about by way of trying to figure out a discipleship vehicle. I had all these guys who were making music and were really gifted, very talented, and wanted to somehow use the music as a means to disciple young men in music. And over the course of a few years, these men just kind of grew both spiritually and in influence. And so we just kind of started making music, and we were always committed to radical generosity. And so we were one of the first record labels to give away all of our music for free. Obviously, this was before the spike in streaming content. And so we did that for about 3 years. We still give away music for free, but we realized just after about 3 years that God had been giving us a lot more influence that was more than just the music. And mm-hmm. so we decided to take a more stewardship approach to what we were doing. And so we continue to make music. Obviously, that gives us influence in the culture. But we also decided to create some other resources like books and video content that addressed particular issues that we felt were really prevalent in the culture in which we did music in. And so, yeah, we've been doing that now for 6 years, and we love it. We this last year, we decided we would try our efforts at a conference. And so we launched the Canvas Conference, where we would talk a little bit about creativity and theology and how those things work together, and how a lot of theologians sometimes miss the creative component, and how creatives oftentimes miss the theological framework. And so, yeah, it was something that we were really passionate about internally, and decided we would try a conference and see if it worked. And the Lord gave us a lot of fruit and a lot of success with it. So we just kind of signed up to do another year of it. So yeah, just a lot of interesting things that kind of all started with a bunch of young guys making music together. And then now we are kind of like this little tiny empire, I guess.
That's awesome.
Music and ministry resources and videos and clothing and conferences and all this stuff. And we really don't know what we're doing. We just, by God's grace, are continuing to push forward with these creative ventures. And so, yeah, well, that's where we are today.
You're doing something right. Well, so let me ask a quick question here about something that I hear through your heart and through your story. We often talk about how leadership development is really a combination of discipleship and development, that those things are really two sides of the same coin. And so as I'm hearing you talking, you know, one of the things is at least the juxtaposition that we sometimes put in our head that, you know, when you said artist and owner, the interesting thing concept about artist and owner is what we typically think the personality types of what we think those two things are. But one of the things that I wanted to draw out is you talked about discipleship, and you talked about these people are developing spiritually, but they're also honing, you know, their skills. Tell me a little bit more about like what that looks like in the life of in the life of your ministry.
Sure. Well, as it pertains to discipleship, I think there's a priority, and the priority is obviously the spiritual growth and spiritual development. And so you can have a young dude who's incredibly gifted and really would just flourish in terms of music or art or creativity or whatever category you file them under. But there is such a great need for discipleship and spiritual development. So if you don't have someone who understands submission to the local church, humility, if they don't understand why God has given them these gifts and what those gifts are to be used for, well, really, you're just left with a bunch of creative people trying to figure out life on their own. And so from the beginning, I always felt it was important to make sure that discipleship with the emphasis on spiritual development was the primary wheelhouse in which we functioned. And so grabbed a bunch of dudes. And the reason why I was an artist with these guys is because I really wanted to do life with them. I wanted to be in the same space that they were at. I didn't want to kind of sit in a tower above them and say, this is how you, you know, make it work. I just wanted to be fully engaged in life with them and allow for them to see the tension of trying to do music while trying to love and support my family, how to do music vocationally, and at the same time, how to do that in a way that honors God and stays submitted to a local church. And so, yeah, I mean, discipleship is at the very core of Humble Beast. And I think as God has increased these guys spiritually, he's also just increased their influence and given them a platform to where you kind of have this idea of each one teach one, you know? So while you pour into one of these dudes, these guys grow and they begin to pour into other people and use their platforms to minister and disciple other people. So it's really a very organic way of discipleship. And it really just looks like doing life with dudes and being radically invested in their life and helping to cultivate not just art, but healthy Christianity.
Did you just get a really good idea?
Listen, I'm trying to turn off my text message alerts because I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. It's like the creative process happening while we're recording. Well, I have one more question before we dive into our five official questions. So, being a hip hop label, one of my favorites. I love the unique sounds that Humble Beast puts out. It's different than hip hop I find anywhere else. I love the lyrical focus and the poetry of it. But what led you to hip hop as the art form that you enjoy most, that you sort of live in? I mean, we haven't talked to any hip hop artists. We haven't talked to any record label people from that, you know, from that sphere. So what drew you into that world as opposed to any other?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been involved in hip hop music since the age of 12. And hip hop, well, first, let me say, I came from a pretty broken home, a lot of father wounds and dad issues. And hip hop at the time was a very creative outlet that gave me a voice and a kind of means of expression. And so before I was a Christian, I was doing hip hop music. And, you know, just trying to figure out how that worked. But hip hop really was a place that there was a certain level of acceptance. There was a certain level of, you know, honing your craft and people validating you. And so you can kind of see a lot of my affirmation as a young man I found in hip hop. And in one sense, hip hop was a part of my identity. But when the Lord was pleased to save me at the age of 18, I began to see this dysfunction, and my identity became less and less fixed in hip hop and more fixed in the person and work of Jesus. And so, you know, I come from a very kind of backpacker hip hop or underground hip hop world.
Yeah.
And most people don't understand what that means, but this will make sense. And so, you know, underground backpacker hip hop was basically a kind of sub genre of hip hop. And so you have this very pop culture hip hop where it's just kind of about, you know, money, women, and drugs, and really just kind of self glorification. But backpacker underground hip hop was really much more about the art and skill of doing what you do. And so there was a very, it was a lot of stock placed in lyricism and wordplay and storytelling. And if you didn't do that well, you really weren't kind of accepted in that subgenre or subculture of hip hop. And so most of the cats that we make music with, they also came from that kind of subculture, subgenre. And so you kind of see in Humble Beast artists, this kind of throwback to technical lyricism, storytelling, wordplay. So that's kind of like why we do what we do and what kind of sets us apart from most kind of pop, hip hop culture, for lack of a better word. So,
well, moving from that, I know things progress over the course of time and they're always shifting and moving. Who are you currently learning from right now, in leadership and life and hip hop?
I mean, to tell you the truth, I probably learn the least of leadership development, spiritual development from hip hop. and that's not to say that there's not a lot of men who have influenced me in the past, but really I would say that my primary influence these days would be from my pastors. So I serve in leadership with them, but I gain a lot of my leadership influence from them because I think they do it the best, and they model leadership in the way that Jesus modeled leadership. So they do it in a very humble and gentle way. They do it in a sacrificial way, in a very service-oriented way. And I feel like that is the best way to do leadership. And so I take my cues and have been taking my leadership cues from them. I mean, before I was a pastor with these men, I was a congregant, and I learned a lot about life and ministry and leadership from these men, and they've been probably the biggest and greatest influence in my life in terms of leadership.
How does that play out just on a week-to-week basis? Obviously, as a pastor now, you're working alongside them as well as learning from them. So are there intentional meetings that you guys have to kind of pour into each other? Are you going through books together? What intentional steps are being taken in terms of learning and growth and things like that?
Yeah, well, we do have, meetings and stuff where we meet and we gauge, but I would say more important than those meetings is the way that these men engage with me on a life-on-life basis. So these men they're giving me encouragement. They're walking me through issues in life with the scriptures. They are encouraging me to continue to persevere even when things look grim. I see the way that they speak into other people's lives, the way that they care for people and shepherd people and disciple people from the pulpit. And so really, it's not as technical as, getting together and going through a book and then, what'd you learn from the book? Oh, I learned this from the book. That's not really how I typically learn. Mm-hmm. I tend to learn a lot by way of example and observing people's life and conduct, and then finding unique ways to take the way that they do their life and finding how it fits in this unique world that I live in. So they might be dealing primarily with pastoral ministry, but I'm able to see how they do life and kind of restructure it and reframe it. So in a sense, I'm sort of pastoring these artists and the staff here by way of serving them, laying my life down for them, speaking words of encouragement to them, trying to treat them as better than myself. And at the same time, when there's areas in their life that need correction, I try to do that gently and with humility. I don't try to lord my leadership over them. And that's really all the cues that I take from just observing my pastors. And so I feel like it works really well,
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me because, there's a lot of knowledge to be gained from things like books and whatnot. But watching people enact it and doing so alongside of them is – I mean, that is
biblical.
Yeah, and that's real life development. I mean, you mentioned how they do leadership development like Christ did it, and that was sharing life, walking and talking and living life simultaneously and setting an example and things like that. So I appreciate how you flesh that out, because I think pastors doing leadership development is a concept, but to hear you talk about it, there's a bit more of a verbal picture there. So thank you.
Oh yeah. And it's more messy, and it's, yes. and feelings can get a lot more hurt. You can feel let down and you can feel hurt by people, but I feel like it's a very healthy way, and it's a real way.
Right.
Textbooks and going through a book together, you know, once a week at a coffee shop, to me just doesn't cut it. So I found that this is a very healthy way of doing it. And I wish everybody would see discipleship like that, because that makes healthy people.
Well, it's great to be in a context where you can do that. I think some people would need to reframe their context a little bit to make room for that, because it's not always something that, I mean, it certainly never happens naturally. It's something that has to be done intentionally, and it doesn't always fit unless things are reshaped a little bit.
For sure, yeah.
So let's hit our second question. And so you mentioned earlier a variety of the things that Humble Beast is part of, in terms of obviously the music, there's blog, there's some books and publications, there's clothing, there's the Canvas conference. You guys used to do some coffee roasting and coffee sales, and then you moved away from that to focus on some other things. So what is the main point of emphasis for your leadership right now, either for the team there as you guys are moving forward, or for yourself and growing as a leader?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're a for-profit entity, but we function like a nonprofit. So
that's not a model that most business consultants would say works.
Yeah,
indeed, and you know, so with that, it comes incredible blessing and a lot of freedom, but it also comes a lot of stress and a lot of creative ways to do ministry, and so. Leadership at Humble Beast looks a lot like, hey, we're going one direction, and we're going to do this for the next 3 months, and then we might have to turn a hard right if this doesn't work, so that we can continue to stay committed to our distinctives. And so, radical generosity is something that we are incredibly passionate about. And so all of our leadership, all of my leadership kind of surrounds that. What do we have to do to protect this radical generosity? And so I think a lot of that has to do with building in the DNA of our staff. Hey, we have to be flexible, pliable, and elastic, because we have to make sure that we have enough money to sustain ourselves. And if we find that what we're doing right now is not sustaining us, we have to kind of make a little bit of an adjustment. And so everybody has to be flexible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's hard for a lot of people. But I think we've been investing in the DNA of the staff to where they're just kind of like, all right, let's do it. Let's do it. So it's part of the makeup of what we do. And so, like you said, we started this coffee company. We did that for 2 years. And really, the coffee company served as a means to generate support for the records that we make, and that for that time was great. But like any business, in order for it to grow, it requires more money, more time, more staff, and more resources. And so part of that was talking through the staff and saying, yo, what does your bandwidth look like? Is this something that we should continue doing? Or is this something that is distracting us from what our primary objective is? And that is to give away these resources where the gospel is richly communicated. And so we kind of sat down together and realized, yo, it's just too much work. And so let's figure out a way that we can generate a little bit more sustainability that doesn't take all of our time away in doing something that we are passionate about coffee, but it's not our primary passion. And so I think it comes down to just teaching and modeling flexibility, pliability, and changing the course of direction for your ultimate ministry.
There are both pastors and church staff, as well as, you know, entrepreneurs and business people that listen to the podcast. So is there any practical steps that you walk through in that process? I mean, you know, I'm a I'm the kind of guy who kind of creates a tool for almost everything or an audit or, you know, something like that. But it sounds like the biggest piece that you did was, as from a leadership perspective, is just ask some really hard questions. What are the types of questions that you walked through when you were making the decision about killing off coffee?
Yeah, I think the first question that you have to begin to ask yourself as well as staff is, you know, when we look at our core objective, are we seeing these side ventures? Are we seeing any ministry fruit from it? We might see fiscal fruit, but are we seeing any real ministry fruit? And how much time are we investing in this side venture? Are we able to justify the lack of ministry fruit? And so basically it just looks like ask these real and honest questions. Is this working? Is this fit within our paradigm of making much about Jesus? If it doesn't, then we need to evaluate it. And that's not to say that we throw everything away, because our online store, we sell merchandise, we sell, apparel, and we try to sell really high quality gear. And that doesn't necessarily communicate rich gospel biblical truth, but it does serve our primary objective of making much about the gospel. And so we look at that and we say, okay, this takes a little bit of time from our everyday task. We have to shoot video content. We have to make marketing resources. But at the end of the day, there's a direct correlation between the selling of these goods and how it impacts the records that we make for people. The coffee didn't necessarily do that. And so we have to take an honest inventory. And it's a constant revisiting, what's our primary objective? Have we deviated too much from what our primary objective is? And you can only know that by way of surveying the people who are doing the work with you. Yeah. I just were to ask myself, well, I probably wouldn't have a very objective perspective about it.
And as somebody who appreciates and enjoys the work that Humble Beast does, I mean, I can attest from the outside that one of the things that drew me to the ministry that you guys do, the music, and I mean even the shirts and things like that, is the quality. The quality of the artistry, the creativity, the quality of the design of things like t-shirts. No, it does not have a direct correlation to reflecting the gospel, but quality work speaks to the standards which you hold, and it speaks to the opinion you have of your customers and those you're trying to reach, because you're trying to give them something of worth and something of value. And so as somebody who, I mean, we see a lot of Christian media and a lot of Christian products. So when I see quality and artfulness, like what you guys do, it absolutely stands out, and it does reflect what you guys are, what you are saying right now.
You know what the kingdom needs?
Brother.
More backpack hip-hop.
That's right. Well.
Well, at the end of the day, I think excellence is part of our theology. And so, we serve a very creative and excellent God, and I think by virtue of that, it drives us to make excellent and creative things. And so it does correlate, but I do appreciate the encouragement, man, because we try hard to make excellent things.
Yeah, I mean, it's the artistry, pursuit of excellence, the whole nine. That's what I, in case the listeners are wondering what I just said, that's what I meant. I mean, the way you described backpack hip hop earlier, and that's what you came out of, you can obviously see that's still a major part of your DNA, mm-hmm. and even from a decision-making process, what you do. So mm-hmm. I just want listeners to hear, when your vision and values are very clear and very clear from the top down, it's a lot easier to make tough decisions.
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier to kill off stuff, because there are tons of listeners right now who have things in their churches that they would love to kill off.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
they can't. And part of it is a culture reason. All right. I'm going to move into our third question. And that is, what are two or three things that you absolutely do every day? You must do those things. And how do they benefit your leadership and your life?
Coffee.
Amen.
I mean, a good cup of coffee, which is kind of legit.
Coffee is a vehicle for the Holy Spirit, I'm convinced.
It is.
Indeed, indeed. Coffee is a gift from God. I would say a couple things. I mean, one, I definitely, and this, some people might view this as so cliche, but I definitely think before I start my day, I need to have just a little bit of time to pray through my day and ask for God's help. I know a lot of people are like, oh, well, you have to pray, you know. But at the end of the day, there's so many moving parts and there's so many things that I would just really have anxiety over if I wasn't setting my mornings by asking for God's help, asking God to make me charitable with my staff, asking for God to give me wisdom, to guide us through difficult decisions. You know, God help me to love my staff well. And help me to not find my identity in my work so that when I leave my work, I mean, that's a really challenging thing for me, to be honest, is to leave my work and then just turn my brain off from all of the tasks that I have. And so I think it starts with me asking for God's help in the morning. And so that's the most practical thing I would suggest. I mean, it works really well for me. It sets my trajectory. The second thing I do is I hate meetings in the morning because I think meetings tend to accentuate all of the stress for the day. And so I tend to not want to come into the office and stress out over like, okay, what do we have to do today? What do we have to do today? So really, I just take time to laugh with my crew. We have like a very interesting office. And so I kind of just typically will jump on the skateboard and roll over to everybody's little section and be like, yo, what up? What are you working on today? How's everything going? How you feeling? Are you overworked? Or, you know, it's usually I try to enter my day by just being a little bit more light and playful and engaging. You know, about midday, jump into some pretty aggressive meetings of everything that we need to do and then take phone calls and stuff like that. And then I usually will start checking my emails after those meetings to stay up to date. So I check my emails twice a day, once in the early afternoon after I've connected with my staff, and then once before I head home. And I tend not to respond to emails at any other point except for those two times. And that works really well for me. And then, I mean, my schedule does flip up a lot. So there's times when I'm touring with Beautiful Eulogy, and then everything flips up. And there's times when I'm doing pastoral stuff where I have to meet with people from my church. And so I take, you know, in the mornings before I come into the office, I'm meeting with coffee for people. And so I designate on Tuesdays and Thursdays those dates. And then on Fridays, man, I honestly just take off and I make those my family days. And so those are like, that's kind of like what my workflow looks like. And it's the exact same thing every single day, unless I'm on the road touring with Beautiful Eulogy. And then that's a whole nother sense of craziness. But
so let me ask a question. There's a little bit of pushback. So you said you check emails twice a day, including so once early afternoon and then once right before you go home. But you also said it's hard to turn your brain off when you go home. Do you think checking emails right before you go home is part of the reason it's hard to turn your brain off?
That's probably, you're absolutely right. It is. But the thing is, you know, we work with distributors and I work with artists who are in different parts of the country. And so it's almost, if there's something that is last minute that needs to get done before I head home, I almost have to check my emails to make sure. Otherwise, no one's getting responded back to until noon the next day. And that's just the nature of our business doesn't allow for me to do that. So
when being on the West Coast, you're 2 and 3 hours earlier than a lot of the other people in the country, which means that, if you don't respond at the end of the day, there's just this lag time too. So I get that. I was just curious.
So it's like, I have to like live and plan my days almost according to like Nashville time. So, you know,
we greatly appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you. Nashville appreciates it. All right, let's hit our fourth question. So we're going to move from the office to home. You mentioned, like we were just talking about, how it can be difficult to kind of leave work at work and head home. But when you get there, what does leadership in your home look like?
I mean, honestly, leadership in my home looks a lot like service. I don't come in and, you know, disrupt the environment that my wife has created all day. I really just come home and I grab my kids and I alleviate my wife. I basically take the 7-month out of her hands, kind of strap him in my little, like, you know, I don't even know what they're
like
called.
Those, like those baby Bjorn things or whatever.
Yeah. It's like a ergo, you know?
Yeah. So yeah.
I just, they don't fit. They don't fit. I tried, but, man.
Listen, what? There's one that's a Target that's a lot less expensive than the Ergo, and it fits so much better on men. And I'll have to explain it to you once I get the name of it. But it's,
I got to be honest, I was kind of happy it didn't work. I'm a large framed man, and I was
just like coming home and being engaged with my family. And so I come in, I take the kids. I usually go on a walk to either there's little park and there's big park depending on the day. So go to the park and hang out so that my wife can get at least an hour or half or hour and a half of, you know, break time. Then I come home and I help my wife with dinner, you know, do like family devotions around 7 o'clock. And that just looks like singing some worship songs, reading from, you know, a children's Bible, going through some catechism stuff, putting the kids down. And then it looks like me washing dishes and cleaning the kitchen. And it's just really like service. And so it looks a lot different than what my daytime looks like. Although service is still a part of it, I'm able to just make a lot of decisions where I have a lot of support and other men kind of coming around side of me, helping me do stuff. When I get home, I don't have anybody helping me do stuff. I really just have to do a lot of stuff. And so... yeah, that's what my leadership looks like. It looks a lot like laying down my exhaustion and fatigue from the day to pick up the slack for my wife so that she can be set up to do the next day. So
well, you're like the Stepford husband.
No, listen, I learned this actually from one of my pastors. He since planted another church, but he told me before I had kids. Now, I waited a long time to have kids. And he told me, he said, the best fathers are the ones who will leave work and come home and give sacrificially to their wife because their wives have been killing themselves all day. He says, you master that and you will be an exceptional father. And that's how you will be an effective leader to your kids. And so really I took my cues from him, another pastor that just told me life in the home looks a lot like coming home and changing diapers and washing dishes and sweeping the floors and helping with dinner. And really, I'm trying to model service for my two kids, even at an early age, so that when they're growing up, they know what it looks like. Leadership looks like serving people, you know?
Well, and Todd and I can both obviously attest to the fact that nothing is more exhausting than taking care of small children for long periods of time. Goodness. So it is definitely an act of service to do that because your wife and any mother of small children has an incredible amount of work throughout the day.
Oh, for sure.
Well,
for
there's, sure. I mean, there's buttons.
Perfectly. You know, I don't always do that perfectly. And I'll always do it like in a non-begrudging way. And I don't always do it like chipper, but the reality is that force myself to be like, nah, man, I just got to suck it up and do it. And yeah, so it's part of life.
Good deal. All right, let's move on to question 5. What would you tell your 20-year-old self about preparing to lead?
Man, my 20-year-old self was a whole different person. I would say at 20 years old, slow down and be more invested in the personal affairs of the people that you lead. Because at the end of the day, if you're not radically invested in their life, both spiritually and personally, your leadership is really going to be bunk. And so real effective leadership would look like, spend more time with people, engage with people on things that are not so connected with business and growth, but be connected with people in terms of their everyday life, laugh with them, take them out to lunch, take them out to dinner. Spend more time with them. That's something I didn't learn until, you know, probably 34. And I feel like that did that, that failed a lot of my beginning stages of leadership. And so I didn't see the kind of fruit, or development in the lives of people until much later, because my investment was superficial.
What, so, you know, you're talking about investment at 20. What are, that's a thing that takes a certain amount of maturity to do. Do you think that you at 20 would have been able to kind of grasp the importance of that and really do that? Or is that something that you only could have learned with time and seasoning and probably some speed bumps along the way?
Yeah, well, I was pretty immature at 20, but I've seen some very mature 20-year-olds today. And so partly I think it just depends on the way that you're made. If you have the ability to observe people and you're more mature at 20, I would say that that's something that you could probably learn by way of watching and modeling people. But for others, for myself, man, I had to learn that. I just kept hitting roadblocks. Like, why is this not working with people? You know, at 20, I had launched my first company. And by 25, I had launched my second company, and I just saw very little fruit, relationally, and from a growth perspective from the people that I was leading. I saw productivity, and output, but I really didn't see a lot more fruit other than that. And so, I learned a lot by way of experience, and so it is something that I think you grow. And I think in the grace of God, he uses our failures to instruct us and guide us and mature us and make us better people than what we once were. So I do think there is a sense that is learned, mm-hmm. but I think people can also observe by just looking at healthy, mature people and seeing the way that they do leadership. Yeah, I think it's maybe both.
Right.
Maybe
both. Well, yeah, and I mean, most 20-year-olds, most young people in general won't learn unless they're getting told the right things. And so it's not an either or, it's getting told the right things and then trying to practice them and learning along the way. I just was asking because being better relationally is something that some people are wired to do well, but most of us, I include myself in this, it's something that we have to intentionally invest in because it's much easier to manage tasks and goals and things like that than it is to invest in people. People are a lot messier and more complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the one point of entry is to listen a lot more and talk a lot less. I mean, that's how you can be intentionally engaged, because then you're not leading it. You're just letting other people lead the conversation and then they start talking about their life. And yeah, I think listening does a whole lot to help you be intentional.
Well, it sounds like from the conversation that we've had too, you're even when you're talking, your leadership style is more asking than telling.
Can be. Yeah, can be. Yeah.
Well, Thomas, thanks so much for the time you've taken to join us, for the thoughtful answers you've given. We really appreciate the conversation and really appreciate the work that y'all are doing at Humble Beast. So thanks so much for jumping on with us.
For sure, man. Thank you guys for taking the time, man.
Absolutely. And for listeners, if you go to humblebeast.com, you can find the blog, you can find the books, you can find music that's available for download, both for sale and for free. For the show notes, go to lifeway.com/leadership. We'll have links to all of these, to the albums, to their website, as well as you can find our blog and the downloads and everything else there as well. So lifeway.com/leadership. Thanks so much for listening and tune in next time.
Don't forget to check out Southeastern Seminary's numerous education and training opportunities to help you grow in ministry. Visit sebts.edu/5LQ to learn more. That's sebts.edu/5LQ.